The Earth moves through stages, epochs. The ancient legends tell us of previous Earth ages, four at least. We are living in the fifth age of man. Each age runs its allotted course and then gives birth to a new age.
Derwin spread his hands out on the table. Quentin, his chin in his hands, stared at the holy hermit in rapt attention. Around them, in Derwin's chambers, candles flickered and filled the room with a hazy yellow glow.
These ages may run 1,000 years or 10,000. Of course, there is no way to tell how long it may last. But the ancients believed that before the end of each age, the world is thrown into turmoil. Great migrations of people commence. Great wars are fought as nations rise against a nation. The heavens are filled with signs and wonders. Then comes the deluge. All the earth is flooded or covered with ice. Then fire burns the earth and erases all sign of the preceding age. It is a time of chaos and darkness, great cataclysms, and death. But out of it comes a new age, both finer and higher than the one before.
As Derwin spoke, an eerie sense of dreadful fascination crept over Quentin. He shrugged it off.
But must the Earth be destroyed completely for a new age to be born?
Derwin mused on this question, but before he could open his mouth to speak, Tolly answered.
Among my people, there are many stories of the times before this one. It is said that the Jair came into being in the Third Age, when the world was still very young, and men talked with the animals and lived in peace with one another. These stories are very old. They have been with us longer than the art of our oldest storytellers to remember. But it is said that the destruction of the world may be averted by some great deed, though what it is that may be done is not known. Tilgal, the Star Maker's son, is said to have saved the world in the Second Age by hitching his horses to his father's chariot and carrying off Morhesh, the Great Evil One, after wounding him with a spear made of a single shaft of light. He threw Morhesh into the pit of the night, and Morhesh's star was extinguished, so the earth did not burn.
Yes, so it is. As I was about to say, it is believed that not every age must end in calamity. The destruction may be lessened or turned aside completely, usually by some act of heroism, some supreme sacrifice, or the coming of a mighty leader to lead mankind into the new age.
Do you believe this?
I believe that what has happened in the past beyond men's remembering did happen. Those who witnessed it explained it as well as they could with the words and ideas they had available to them. Certainly, much remains unexplained, but it seems strange that each race has, somewhere in its past, memories such as this.
I meant, do you believe that the star in the sky betokens the end of the age?
I believe a new age is coming, yes. Such as the world has never known. A time of mighty upheaval and change. And I believe change does not take place without struggle, without pain. So it is.
It all seems very grim to me.
You should not think of the pain involved. Think instead of the greater glory of the new age.
Tolly and Quentin had ridden from Narramur to Derwin's cottage in Pelgrin Forest. They made good time and arrived late in the afternoon, just as the sun slipped into the treetops. But despite the late hour, they had found Derwin absent and his traveling cloak missing. They had then decided to ride through the night and reached Ascalon's mighty gates as the moon set in the west. Not wishing to disturb the servants or awaken the king and queen, they went instead to the chambers kept for Derwin when he was in residence at the castle. There, to their surprise and pleasure, they found the hermit slumped in his chair with a scroll rolled up on his lap. He was sound asleep and snoring. Upon their entrance, despite their attempts to be quiet, Derwin awakened and greeted them warmly.
You have ridden all night! You are hungry. I will fetch you some food from the kitchen.
He hurried away with a candle in his hand, while Quentin and Tolly pulled off their cloaks, dipped their hands in the basin, and attempted to wash away their fatigue. They then settled themselves, exhausted, into chairs, and dozed until Derwin returned with bread and cheese and fruit that he had pinched from the pantry.
Here, now, sit at this table and eat while I tell you what I have been doing since last we met.
Derwin told them of his studies and his healing work among the peasants, and at last Quentin told him about their audience with Bjorkus and their discussion about the star, which nightly grew brighter. They had talked long and late. At last they rose from the table and turned to curl themselves in their chairs to sleep.
Derwin, you have a visitor, I believe. Do you entertain so late at night?
I, as you well know, did not expect a single person in my chambers tonight, and I find not one but two. So now I entertain any possibility. Open the door and let them in, please.
Quentin stepped to the door and opened it. He was not prepared for the greeting he received.
Quentin, my love, you are here!
Instantly, Quentin's arms were thrown wide as he swept up a young woman in a long white woolen robe.
Bria!
No!
And buried his face in her hair.
I did not know how much I missed you until this moment.
The two lovers clung in a long embrace, breaking off suddenly when they remembered that they were not alone. Quentin set his lady back upon her slippered feet and drew her into the room. Derwin and Tolly smiled as they looked on.
What brings you to this hermit's chambers so late at night?
Why, I was passing without, and I fancied I heard voices. I fancied one of them was yours, my love.
Ah, your lips utter the answer my ears long to hear. But come, I have much to tell you. Much has happened since I was with you last.
Not here, you don't. In a very short time, this chamber will ring with the snores of the sleeping. You two doves must take your cooing elsewhere.
Derwin beamed happily as he shooed them out the door. Quentin and Bria walked hand in hand along the darkened passageway and out onto the same balcony the princess and Derwin had occupied only a night before. Dawn's crimson fingers stretched into the sky in the east, though the sun lingered below the far horizon, and one or two stars could still be seen above.
I have missed you, my darling lighted Bria.
My heart has mourned your absence.
I am here now, and with you. I find my greatest happiness when I am at your side.
But you will leave again too soon, I fear. My father has a task for you, and we will be separated again.
Do you know what it is?
No.
Then how do you know it will take me away from you so suddenly?
A woman knows.
Well, then we will have to make each moment we are together so much the sweeter.
Quentin pulled her to him gently and kissed her. She wound her arms around him and rested her head upon his chest. Quentin looked at the placid sky as its rosy red brightened to a golden hue. The mighty ramparts of Ascalon Castle gleamed like burnished gold, magically transformed from their ordinary state of dull stone by the dawn's subtle alchemy.
Quentin, what is happening? I am afraid, though I do not know why. The king holds his own council and will see no one. And when I ask him about affairs in the realm, he only smiles and pats my hand and tells me that a princess should think of only happy things and not concern herself with mundane matters. I am worried for him. Oh, Quentin, when you see him, you will know he is not well. He is pale and drawn. Some dark care sits heavily upon his brow. My mother and I know not what to do.
Calm yourself, Bria, my love. If there is anything I may do to ease his mind, count on it that it shall be done. And if medicines have any effect, Derwin will know it and will avail. And yet, I must confess that I am troubled too. By nothing so easily explained, would that it were. I would give a fortune to anyone who could calm the turmoil I feel growing inside me. There is trouble, Bria. I feel it, though all about me appears peaceful and serene. I start at shadows, and night gives me no rest. It is as if the wind itself whispers an alarm to my ears. But no sound is heard.
Oh, what is happening? What will become of us, my darling?
I do not know, but I promise you this. I will love you forever.
They held each other for a while, and the new sun rose and filled the sky with golden light.
See how the sun banishes the darkness. So love will send our troubles fleeing far from us, I promise.
Can love accomplish so much, do you think?
It can do all things.
Good Thedo, we have already come too far, and it is past time when we should have been in Ascalon. The king will be fearing our disappearance soon, if not already.
But we have not seen what we came to see, the enemy, if there is one. We would be remiss if we return now. Our task is not completed.
Ronsard sat hunched in the saddle, one arm resting on the pommel, the other bent around behind him as he pressed his hand into the small of his back.
If I do not get off this horse soon, I may never walk again.
Since when have you become fond of walking? The Lord High Marshal of the realm should set a better example for his men.
Thedo swiveled in his saddle to cast an eye upon the four knights behind.
My men know me for what I am, but I jest not when I say that we should return at once. It is no light thing to keep a king waiting.
Nor is it meet to bring him useless information. The one would foil his purpose as easily as the other. But I will tell you what we shall do, so that I may hear the end of your complaining. We will send one of the knights back with a message of what we have discovered so far, and of our intention of continuing until we are satisfied.
Fair enough. Also relay that we will return at the earliest we may, by the most expeditious means, with a full report.
Agreed.
Martran, come up here.
The knight approached his leaders on foot and saluted.
Martran, you are to ride to the king at once and deliver this message. We are continuing on our mission, and are sorry for the delay in returning to him sooner. Tell him also that we will come hence as soon as we are satisfied that we have obtained that which we seek, or have some better report to give him. Do you understand?
Yes, my lord.
Repeat the message.
The knight repeated the message word for word, with the same inflection given the words as Ronsard himself had used.
Very well. Be on your way. Stop for nothing and no one.
The knight saluted again and walked back to his horse. He mounted and rode off at once, without looking back.
Now then, let us go forth.
Ronsard raised himself in his saddle.
Be mounted! Forward we go!
Since leaving Ascalon, they had ridden further and further south, first to Hinsonby and then along the coast as it dipped toward the Southland region of Mensendor. They had passed through Persh and a host of peasant villages unnamed on any map. Now they approached a rocky stretch of coastland which rose in sharp cliffs at the brink of the sea. This was where the Fiscal Mountains spent themselves in their southernmost extremity. The crags marched right down to the sea, and there the land dropped away, as if it had been divided by the chop of an axe. The sea lay crowded with jagged teeth of immense rocks, some as big as islands, though they jutted sharply out of the ocean's swell, bare and lifeless, uninhabited except as roosts for myriads of squawking seabirds. A narrow, treacherous track climbed upward through the cliffs and entwined itself among the tors. Now it cut through a wall of rock so narrow that a man's outstretched hands touched either side, and now it swung out upon the sheer cliff face, where one misstep would send horse and rider hurtling down into the churning sea. They halted.
I suggest we stop here for the night. I would not like to trust that trail by night. It is bad enough in the daylight.
Very well. A fresh start at it in the morning would not be disagreeable to me.
They removed themselves but a little away from the trail and set about making camp for the night. As the sun slid down below the dark rim of the sea, the birds fluttered to the roosting rocks. After a while, the moon ascended and cast its pale light all around.
Listen.
Thedo cast a wondering glance toward his old friend.
Oh, I guess it was nothing.
In a moment, Ronsard was on his feet. Then he walked a short way along the road and stood for a long time looking toward the cliff trail. Thedo watched him narrowly and was not surprised when the brawny knight came hurrying back.
What is it?
Someone is coming up, there in the cliffs, I am certain of it. Put out the fire and take the horses aside. Hide yourselves and watch me for a signal.
In the space of 5 heartbeats, the small camp was deserted, and no sign remained that only a moment before 5 knights had been encamped there. Then Ronsard and Thedo sat down to wait in the dark alongside the road, hidden from view by a low-lying clump of hart's tongue. Murky shapes could be seen against the night sky as they drew nearer. They were on foot, and there were smaller shadows among the larger ones. They huddled together in a close knot, rather than ranging themselves along the trail. They evidently feared separation more than detection.
It is no army. But now to find out who they are and why they risked the cliffs in the night, the very thing we declined to do.
We had a choice. Perhaps they felt they had none.
Ronsard rose from his place and stepped near to the trail, just ahead of the nocturnal traveler's leader.
Halt, friend! In the name of the Dragon King!
The man stopped dead in his tracks and looked about him for the source of the unexpected command. Ronsard stepped closer, and the moonlight fell on his face. He smiled and held up his hands to show the frightened travelers that he meant them no harm.
What do you want?
I wish to speak with you, that is all. I will not detain you long.
Who are you?
I am the Lord High Marshal of Menzendor. Who are you, and whither do you run by the light of the moon?
Oh, sir, you do not jest. You are really a king's man?
At your service. Are you in trouble?
At this, all the people rushed forward and drew close around Ronsard, as if to seek the protection of his title, a welcome shield over their heads. Thedo crept from his hiding place and came to stand beside Ronsard, who held up his hands.
Please, I beg of you to be silenced. I think I would better hear the tale from only one mouth at a time. You are the leader of this band.
Ronsard pointed to the man he had addressed at first.
You begin.
The man's face shone pale in the moonlight, but Thedo got the impression that it would be pale in bright daylight as well. Deep lines of fear were drawn on the man's countenance. His eyes did not hold steady, but shifted to the right and left and all around, as if to warn him of the imminent approach of an enemy.
It
is all right. You are safe for the time. I have soldiers with me, and we will defend you at need.
Come, you may speak freely.
We are from Dom. We left our homes to carry all our belongings with us. We are going to the High Temple. We know not elsewhere to go.
It is a strange pilgrimage you make, my friend. Why do you leave your homes and flee by night?
Have you not heard? They are coming. A terrible host, terrible. They have landed at Halidom and they are coming. Why, we are fleeing for our lives to the protection of Ariel. Only the god can save us now.
Who is coming? Have you seen anyone?
Do you not know? How is this possible? The whole land is in turmoil. We are fleeing for our lives.
Ronsard and Thedo drew aside to confer.
Something has frightened these people, that much is clear. Though what remains a mystery, I can make no sense out of it.
Thedo called the leader over to where they stood.
Good sir, have you seen someone? This enemy you flee from, do you know from whence he comes?
Well, we have seen no one, but we dared not wait. 2 days ago, men of Halidom in the Southlands came to Dom. They told us of terrible things which had happened there. A mighty enemy has risen up and drives all before him. Their city was burned and the streets ran with the blood of children, women. Those that would save their lives fled to the hills. So we flee while we still may.
This enemy, did you hear a name?
It's too terrible to say.
Terrible it may be, but we will hear it. Tell what you know.
Ronsard's authoritative tone seemed to have a calming effect upon the frightened peasant.
It is Nin, the Destroyer.
Thedo looked blankly at Ronsard, and then back at the frightened peasant. The man's eyes glittered wide and round in the moonlight. As appalling as the name was to the peasant, enough at least to inspire a whole village to flight at the very sound of it, the name meant nothing to Thedo or Ronsard.
I have never heard this name.
Ronsard shook his head and looked hard at the peasant.
Is there another name by which this enemy may be known? We know nothing of this Nin or his armies.
No, there is no other name that I know.
Halidom was destroyed? These men that came to Dom, they saw it destroyed?
Yes, so they said. Some of them have lost everything, home and family, possessions, everything.
Thedo turned to Ronsard.
There is where we will find our answers, at Halidom.
So it would seem. We will go there and see what may be seen. The king will want to know in any case.
Thedo turned back to the leader of the fleeing people.
This Nin you speak of, he was moving toward Dom, you say. How did you know if you did not see him?
The men of Halidom told us. The enemy ranges the whole countryside. No place is safe from him. That is why we go to the High Temple at Narumor to ask the god to protect us.
There may be a safer place than even the temple. I have lands at Urlot which need the work of many hands. Go there and present yourself to my steward, called Toffin. Tell him his master sends you to him, that he may give you shelter and food and land to work. And give him this.
Thedo drew a small round token from the pouch at his belt, a clay tile baked hard with his signet pressed into it. The peasant stared at the signet tile and then at Thedo. He seemed as much dismayed by it as by Nin himself.
Are we to be sold into slavery because we have no place to go? We have left our homes to become serfs of the king's men?
My offer is honorable. You may take it or no. I do not withdraw it. I keep no serfs. All who work my lands are free and enjoy the fruits of their labors in equal share. If you doubt my words, go there and see for yourselves. In any case, you are free to leave or stay once you have seen. No one compels you to do as I bid. Only know this. If you stay, you will be required to do your share and to work the land that is given you. If you do not, your place will be given to another who will.
The man looked at the token in Thedo's hand. He reached out for it hesitantly, casting a sideways glance to the others in his band.
We too are honorable, though we are but men of low birth.
The leader snatched the tile out of Thedo's hand.
We will go to your lands at Erlat and inquire of your steward. We will see how he receives us. If he bears the goodwill of his master, you will find us busy in your fields when you return from your duties.
He bowed stiffly from the waist and turned to go. He paused and turned back again.
If it be as you say, you have our thanks, my lord.
I do not ask for thanks, but only that you will do as we have agreed. That shall be for me more than gratitude itself.
The man bowed again and went to where his people waited to learn the outcome of the interview just concluded. Words were exchanged quickly, and suddenly the band was on its way again, but bolder this time and changed in mood. Several of the refugees waved their thanks to Thedo as they passed, as they moved hurriedly away down the trail.
Well, you have done your fellows a fine service this night. I hope you will not have cause to regret your kindness.
One never regrets a kindness, my friend, but I have no doubt that I have gained as much as they in the bargain.
How so?
Good land needs the plowman's hand to bring it to life, and a husband to care for it. If I did not have men to work my fields, they would soon become barren and worthless. These men do me great service by helping me care for my lands. Rightly managed, there is more than enough for everyone.
Well, I hope we may see your trust proved true. But why not? The realm has known nothing but peace these many years, and we are at peace still.
I wonder.
Quentin hastened along wide corridors lined with rich tapestries toward the Dragon King's apartments. Upon rising, he had been summoned to meet with the king in the private council chambers, and had dressed in fresh garments, a new tunic and trousers of forest green, and a short summer cloak of blue, edged in green and gold. The finely embroidered cloak, fastened with a brooch of gold at his shoulder, fluttered out behind him as he swept along. Just as he stepped up to the door which opened onto Escobar's apartments, the door swung inward, and Oswald, the Queen's Chamberlain, emerged.
Sir, if you would but come aside with me, my lady would have a word with you.
Oswald smiled his request, but his gray eyes insisted. So Quentin nodded his assent and followed the Chamberlain. They withdrew to a room just across the corridor from the King's chambers.
Quentin is here, Your Majesty.
Quentin stepped into the room behind the Chamberlain and saw Queen Alenia sitting on a bench in the center of the room with her hands folded in her lap. Her eyes were bent toward the floor, but her look was far away, and Quentin saw lines of worry creasing her noble brow. When he entered, the Queen sat up, and her face was suddenly transformed by a beautiful smile. Instantly, the dim chamber seemed filled with light. She rose as he came to her and held out her arms to embrace him. Quentin hugged her and brushed her pale cheek with his lips. She kissed both of his.
Quentin, you have come. Oh, I'm so glad you are here. Your journey was not unpleasant, I trust. It is good to have you back. The months seem long when you were away.
Alenia gripped his hand in both of hers and led him to the bench.
Please, sit with me but a little. I know the king is waiting, but it is important. I would have a word with you before you enter his presence.
Her sparkling green eyes, deep and serene as forest pools, searched his for a moment, as if deciding whether the hearer would be strong enough to bear the words she had to say.
Quentin, the king is very ill.
So I have learned from Bria. We met this morning when I arrived. She told me of her concern for his health.
But I think even Bria does not guess how far he has fallen. She is devoted to her father and loves him with all her heart. but she does not know him as I do. Something consumes him before my eyes. It gnaws at him from within, stealing his strength and sapping away his spirit. Do not wonder at what I tell you. You will see for yourself soon enough. He has greatly changed since last you saw him. It is all I can do to keep from weeping in his presence.
My queen, I am your servant. Say the word and I shall do whatever you require.
Only this. Take no unusual notice when you go in to see him. Be to him as normally. Do not let on that you believe him ill, or that I have told you anything of his condition.
I promise it. But is there nothing else I may do?
No, I know you would if you could. But I have sent for Derwin and have placed a heavy charge on him. It may take all of his healing powers to restore the king, even if he is not now beyond them.
I will pray to the Most High that Derwin's cures may have effect.
That is my course as well. Go to him now, my son, and remember what I told you.
I will, my lady. You need not fear.
Quentin quietly left the room, and when he had stepped back into the corridor, he found Oswald waiting for him. The chamberlain led him back to the king's chambers.
Your Majesty, Quentin is here.
Quentin stepped across the threshold. In the center of the high-ceilinged chamber sat a heavy, round oaken table, shaped like the room itself, for it was a part of one of Ascalon's many towers. Small round windows of amber glass tinted the afternoon light with a warm hue. Escobar was standing in a shaft of light from one of these windows, his back turned, gazing out onto the courtyard below. There was an awkward moment when Quentin could not speak, and the king did not seem to have heard the chamberlain's announcement. Quentin hesitated, feeling suddenly trapped. Then the king turned slowly and fixed his eyes upon Quentin. A thin smile stretched his lips.
Quentin, my son, you've come.
If not for the queen's warning, Quentin didn't know what he would have done. He bit his lower lip to stifle a cry, and then recovered himself and forced a grin.
I came as soon as I could. Tolly's horses are magnificent. I believe they have wings. We flew over the land at a fair pace.
Still smiling the sad, weak smile of a dying man, the king advanced slowly and offered his hand. Quentin took it without hesitation and couldn't help noticing how weak the king's grip had become and how cold the feel of his hand. Escobar's flesh had taken on a waxen pallor and his eyes seemed to burn with a dull, feverish light. His lips were cracked and raw, and his hair, that crowning glory of rich dark curls, hung limp and lifeless, and had turned now almost completely gray. Quentin found himself staring at the face of a strange man, who looked at him intently with sunken eyes, rimmed with dark circles. Quentin looked away quickly.
This is a cheery room, sire. Will we be alone, or are others expected?
Others will come, but not yet. I wanted to speak to you alone first. Please, sit down.
The king lowered himself slowly into a chair at the round table, and Quentin followed. He wanted to weep at the sight of Escobar, the mighty Dragon King, who was now tottering like an old man. How could this be? How could such a change be wrought in such a short time? In a scant 8 or 9 months, the king had deteriorated to a shocking degree. Quentin wanted to dash from the room, to remove himself far away from the creature who sat beside him and who wore the king's crown. Escobar gazed into the young man's eyes with a look of inexpressible gentleness. A fatherly compassion, which Quentin had never seen there before, suddenly flowered. Quentin was strangely moved and forgot for a moment the horror of the king's shattered health.
Quentin, as you know, I have no son, no heir to my throne save Bria. My brother, Prince Jaspin, is banished, never more to return. I think it's time for me to choose my successor.
Oh, no, sire. Now is not the time to think of such things. You have many years ahead of you. You're strong yet.
No, it is not to be. Quentin, I am dying.
No.
Yes. Hear me. Slowly it may be, but I am dying. I shall not live to see another spring. It is time for me to set my house in order. I intend to choose you as my successor. Since you are not in direct bloodline, it will have to go before the Council of Regents, but I expect no problem there. As I have chosen you myself, they will ratify my choice gladly.
Quentin sat gazing at his folded hands, speechless. The king's words had stricken him mute.
You honor me greatly, sire, but I am not worthy of such high court. I am an orphan and of no noble birth. I am not worthy to be a king.
You, Quentin, are my ward. You have been a son to me as I have watched you grow to manhood these last years. I want you and no other to wear my crown.
I do not know what to say, my lord.
Say but that you will do as I command. Ease my heart in this matter.
Quentin stood up from his chair and then went down on his knees before his king.
I am ever your servant, sire. I will obey.
Escobar placed a hand upon Quentin's head.
Now my heart can rest. Rise, sir. One king does not kneel to another. From this day on, you are considered the heir to the throne of Mensendor.
In walked Tolly and Derwin. Tolly hesitated at the sight of the king, but Derwin did not flinch at all. He hurried to the table and with a quick bow began talking of his travels, all the while keeping a close eye on the ailing monarch, as if weighing him for some remedy.
Good, good. Be seated, both of you. We have a matter to discuss.
The king looked at his comrades closely.
For some time I have been of an uneasy mind, restless, hungry, and uneasy. At first I attributed this to the illness which consumes me, but it is more than that, I fear. It is from Mensendor my unease persists. There is some distress in the realm.
Quentin realized that Escobar had so long been the head of his land that he had developed a special feeling for it and knew instinctively when something was wrong. It was as if a part of him were hurt, and he felt the wound. He had discerned trouble before anyone else had suspected even the slightest eddy in the current of peace and prosperity that flowed throughout the kingdom. It struck Quentin absurdly at first, but with growing conviction that perhaps what ailed the land was the cause of the king's distress as well.
To prove my intuition, I summoned the faithful Thedo and Ronsard to me and sent them with a small force to discover, if they could, whence the trouble came. The time for their return has now passed. I have received no word or sign from them, and I am anxious for what may have befallen them. That is why I have summoned you. It becomes ever more urgent that we discover the source of our harm before it is too late. There is evil afoot, I feel it. Each day it grows the stronger. If we do not find it soon and crush it out...
My lord, we have seen portents which would indicate the prudence of your fears.
And I as well.
Tolly and Derwin shared with the king the signs they had observed, for shadows of an impending evil they could not identify. Quentin noted that as his two comrades spoke, and especially when they mentioned the Wolf Star, Escobar appeared to fall even further beneath the weight of his kingdom's peril.
Quentin and Tolly, my brave friends, we must discover wherein our danger truly lies. My people require your courage.
We will go at once and seek out this evil. And it may be we will find good Thedo and Ronsard as well.
Quentin said nothing, but stared from one to another of the faces around the table.
Very well. You know I would not send you out thus if I thought it were but a small thing, or if another could serve as well.
The king turned and looked at Derwin thoughtfully.
You, sir, I did not summon. But as usual, one who knows me better than I know myself has doubtless interceded. I will detain you, good hermit, that you may remain with me. I may soon have need of your ministrations, and perchance your arts will be better employed here than on the back of a horse.
So it is. I will abide.
How soon will you ride?
We will leave at once, sire.
It is well. But stay and share my table tonight at least. I want to see my friends all together before...
The king did not finish the thought.
The village has been subdued, most excellent one.
The rider bowed low in his saddle. Behind him, black smoke ascended in a thick, dark column to be scattered by the wind blowing in from the sea. His sorrel pony jerked its reins and tossed its head, its hide besmeared with soot. and dried blood.
There was no resistance.
Savage eyes watched the messenger from beneath the rim of an iron helm, ornamented with black plumes which fluttered like wings in the wind.
You four, stay with the men and occupy this place. You others come with me. We ride at once. Follow.
But what is to be done with the prisoners, most excellent one?
Kill them.
The room hung heavy with a pungent fragrance of burning incense, and clouds of the aromatic vapor drifted about the great figure, seated on a throne of silk cushions. Presently, a chime sounded in the passageway beyond. The gigantic form seated on the throne appeared to be asleep, for he did not move or acknowledge the intrusion in any way. The huge head remained resting on the great barrel of a chest. The meaty hands clasping one another in the wide lap remained motionless, thumbs pressed together.
Immortal one, I have news!
The minister waited on his knees with his forehead pressed to the floor, hands thrust before him, palms upward.
You may speak, Uzla.
Your warlords had returned, and they bring tidings of victory. The cities of the coast are subdued.
Has a suitable residence been found for me?
Alas, no, immortal one. These were but small villages, and none possessed a dwelling worthy of your being. For this effrontery, the villages have been burned and the ashes scattered, lest the sight of them displease you.
Nin the Destroyer looked darkly upon his most trusted minister.
This land will feel my wrath.
Uzla, the Prime Minister, cowered below him on the floor.
Oh, the wretches of this accursed land speak of many castles in the north, and one in particular which may serve your needs while you sojourn here to subject this land to your will.
What is the name of this palace?
It is called Ascalon. It is the city of the High King of this land, one known as the Dragon King.
The sound of these words pleases me. Say them again.
Ascalon is the home of the Dragon King.
It will be my home, and I will be the Dragon King. This pleases me. I have never killed a dragon before, have I, Uzla?
No, my deity. Not to my knowledge. That is, unless in a previous life, of course.
Then I will look forward to that event with anticipation. I will savor the moment of its accomplishment.
The Destroyer Nin stood slowly.
Now, where are my warlords?
They await you on the beach. I will summon them.
No, I will go to them. They have achieved my desires and will be rewarded by the sight of their god drawing near to them.
Oh, as you command, O Great One.
Uzla bowed again and raised himself from the floor. He turned and withdrew to the hall.
The deity walks! Kneel before him, everyone!
Nin followed slowly, balancing his immense bulk upon ponderous legs. As they reached a short flight of stairs which led upward to the deck of the palace ship, Uzla clapped his hands again, and eight attendants brought a throne on poles. They placed the throne before their king, and he lowered himself into it. Then, straining every muscle, the chair-bearers climbed the steps, careful to keep the throne leveled, lest they incur the wrath of their temperamental god. Soon, they moved out upon the deck. Two more attendants waited on deck with large shades made of brilliant feathers. As soon as Nin's chair emerged out upon the deck, the huge, burly head was shaded from the bright sunlight of a beautiful summer day. The attendants swayed under the weight of their burden, but proceeded down a long ramp which had been erected out over the shallow water from the palace ship to the shore. The ramp terminated in a platform on the beach, forming a dais from which Nin the Destroyer could command his subjects. At the sight of this procession moving slowly down the ramp, the four warlords dismounted and drew near to the dais, prostrating themselves in the sand. The chair-bearers reached the platform and placed the mobile throne squarely in the center of the dais, beneath a broad canopy of rich blue silk. Then they withdrew to await the next command. They knelt with their faces touching their knees. The blue silk of the canopy ruffled in the soft breeze. Above the dais, gulls wheeled in the air. Nin raised his hands.
Arise, my warlords. You may look upon your deity.
The warlords, clad in their heavy armor, rose stiffly to their feet and stood shoulder to shoulder before their patron.
I've seen your victory from afar. With my own eyes, I witnessed the flames of destruction. I am well pleased. Now tell me, my commanders, what is the strength of this land? Is there an army to stand before the destroyer's blade?
Nin looked at the four fighting men and nodded to one of them, who stepped forward slowly.
Good.
The warrior struck his heart with his closed hand. His long, straight black hair was pulled tightly back and bound at the back of his head in a thick braid. Quick black eyes set in a smooth, angular red face watched Nin closely.
I have seen no soldiers in the south, immortal one. The peasant villagers were unprotected.
Amut.
This warrior, a member of the Yellow Race, advanced. His gleaming head was shaved completely bald, except for a short bob of hair which he wore tied in a tight knot. On his cheeks and forehead were strange blue tattoos, and a ragged scar streaked from the corner of one almond-shaped eye to the base of a thick, muscular neck.
In the north, we encountered no soldiers. Great one. The cowardly populace fled before our arrows like leaves before the storm.
Luok.
Luok touched his bearded chin with a brown hand. His head was covered in a helm of white horsehide, which sprouted a short plume made from a horse's tail at its crest. He was tall and lean, and when he opened his wide mouth to speak, a row of pointed white teeth flashed.
I encountered but one village in the mountainous interior of this land, named Galinpur. No army could cross these mountains in surprise. We may turn our eyes elsewhere.
Bogaz.
The last warlord, a towering black man whose features were hidden beneath the black veil which covered the lower part of his face, revealing only the large dark eyes, took his place beside the others. His head was encased in a horn-covered leather helmet, and he wore a breastplate made of flat discs of horn which had been linked together with iron rings. A long red cape fell from his shoulders to the heels of his black boots. At his side he carried, as they all did, a curious curved sword with a thin tapering blade honed dagger sharp on both edges.
And I too have seen those soldiers. The villages offered no resistance. The blood of the stubborn ran red upon the ground, and their ashes ascended to heaven in your honor, immortal Nin.
With that, the black warrior touched his forehead and bowed low.
What land is this which builds no walls around its cities and leaves the small villages unprotected? Here is wealth for the taking, my warlords. We will push to the north, to Ascalon, and there I will establish my palace, so that I may be comfortable while bringing this land under my rule. Go now and bring me word when the castle is mine, that I may come at once and take possession of what I desire. But do not make sacrifice of the king. I will have that pleasure for my own. His blood will flow for me alone. Hear and obey.
Heavy dew still clung to the leaves as the first rays of golden morning broke upon the countryside. Near the sea, such dew was common, but it never ceased to delight Quentin when the sun struck each tiny droplet of moisture and turned it into a glimmering gem. Each hillock and bush seemed to acquire inestimable value.
Ah, it is good to be alive.
This morning the saddle seems a friend to you. That is not the impression you gave me last night.
In the morning the world is recreated. All things are made new, including saddles.
It is good to see my master in such high humor. For the last 3 days, one would have mistaken you for a growling bear. Not that I noticed.
I am sorry if I've been out of sorts. I have had much on my mind these past few days. It is like a shadow has been hovering over me. But now I can see clearly again.
That is well for both of us.
The two riders approached and mounted the crest of a long sloping hill. Here they paused for a short while and contemplated the road before them and the valley beyond, in the center of which lay the village of Persh.
See how quiet it is. So peaceful. This is how it has been for 1,000 years.
We will pray that it may remain so for another 1,000.
As they drew nearer to the seaside village, Tolly grew tense with concentration. Quentin noticed the change in his companion's attitude.
What is it? What do those eagle eyes of yours see?
Nothing, Master. That is what worries me. I see no one, no activity in the village at all.
Perhaps the people of Persh are late abed and late to rise.
Or maybe they have a reason for remaining behind doors on such a day as this, though that reason is certain to be born of fear.
It will not be the first time we have encountered such this trip.
Quentin placed his free hand on the hilt of his sword and shifted it slightly to bring it into readiness. His eyes scanned the breadth of the town, drawing slowly closer with each step. He saw not a sign of life, either human or animal, in the streets or on the road before them. Certainly that was strange. Ordinarily, the first rays of morning light would find the narrow little streets busy with citizens going about their daily chores. The merchants would be opening their stalls in the marketplace, and the craftsmen their awnings. Farmers would be offering cheese and melons and eggs in exchange for cloth and various metal utensils. Wives would be carrying water from the well in the town square, and children would be scampering around corners and darting to and fro in noisy play, while the village dogs barked and dodged their bare, sun-browned legs. But this morning, there was no such bustle and fuss. The empty street seemed haunted by the eerie absence of the villagers. The riders entered the main street of the town. Quentin always thought that the white shell streets gave all seaside towns a fresh, clean appearance. This day, however, the whitened streets looked desolate, sepulchral. No face appeared, even fleetingly, in a doorway or darkened window.
Everyone is gone.
I do not believe it. Everyone cannot have left. Someone must have remained behind. A whole village does not disappear, not without good cause.
They reached the village square. It was an irregular rectangle formed by the fronts of Persh's principal buildings. The inn, which was rumored to serve a most remarkable fish stew, the communal hall. Since no nobleman dwelt in Persh, the citizens had erected their own great hall in which to observe feasts and holy days, the marketplace and the stalls of the vendors, the small temple and shrine to the god Ariel, and the dwellings of the craftsmen. In the center of this rectangle stood a large well, and on a mound beside it, an immense old cedar tree spread forth its shaggy limbs to offer shade to all who gathered there. Quentin and Tolly drew up to the well and dismounted.
Not a sound. Not a sight. And yet, I feel that we are not alone.
I feel someone close by. I also feel their fear.
Tolly replaced the bucket carefully, and then motioned for Quentin to mount up again. Quentin did so with a questioning look, and the two rode the rest of the way through the village. When they reached the last dwelling, Tolly led them aside.
We were not entirely alone back there. I felt someone's eyes upon us. Let us leave the horses here and go back by another way.
They crept quietly along a pinched alleyway between buildings, and soon made their way back to the square. There was nothing to be seen. It all looked just as it had only moments before.
Well, it appears we should look elsewhere. Perhaps we may try one of the dwellings.
Wait but a moment more and I will join you.
Wait. Listen. He's getting away!
Quentin dived around the edge of the dwelling, in time to see a leg and a hand disappear behind an overgrown yew thicket.
He is making for the basin! We will catch him this way!
Tolly bounded away, and Quentin followed in his fleet steps. They tumbled down the path together and jumped down the rock steps placed in the side of the sandy hill, which separated the town from the strand below. Ahead of them lay the boat basin, the small cove which formed the harbor of Persh. There, between two fishing boats resting with their black hulls skyward, a small skiff with a white triangular sail had been thrust upon the sand. And hurrying nimbly along the sand toward the skiff ran the slight figure of a young man. Quentin darted out onto the beach in pursuit.
Hold, sir! Stop! We mean you no harm! We only wish to talk!
The figure half turned, and only then saw the two men watching him. Though Quentin and Tolly were too far away to make out the features of his face, the effect of Quentin's words was quite obvious.
You have frightened him! Come on!
The young stranger had reached the skiff and was shoving the boat into the water with all his might. It seemed to have caught on something, or perhaps the tide had withdrawn somewhat since the boat had been left there, making it harder to push free. But with a strength of desperation, the stranger succeeded in launching the small sailboat and was thrashing through knee-deep water to turn the boat around before clambering in, fish-like, over the side. Tolly reached the water's edge first and jumped in. Quentin plunged in after him, and both waded toward the boat. The stranger, paddling furiously with a long oar, cast a terrified look over his shoulder. Quentin waded toward one side of the boat, and Tolly splashed toward the other. Once they were within range, the oar whistled above their heads.
Be still, good sir! Desist! We mean you no harm!
As Quentin thus occupied the boy's attention, Tolly moved behind him toward the bow. The youngster turned and brought the oar down on the gunwale. Quentin, seeing the stranger momentarily off balance following the delivery of the blow, seized the stem with both hands and gave the boat a mighty twisting shove. Quentin ducked the splash, and Tolly swung himself around the side of the skiff to face Quentin. Between them floated the fisherman's hat. Quentin reached into the shallow water, snagged a hold on the stranger's collar, and hauled him to his feet.
Well, what have we here? Tolly, I think we've caught ourselves at...
Now it was Quentin's turn to be surprised.
A girl!
Quentin held the dripping hat, now a soggy black bag in his hands, and looked in wonder at the long dark tresses, now wet and ropey, glistening in the sun. The young woman's dark lashes blinked over clear ice blue eyes as she shook away the water streaming down her face. She had soft, well-shaped features, and her cheeks bore the ruby blush of excitement.
Let me go! I am nobody! I have no money! Let me go!
Peace! We will do you no harm, m'lady.
The young woman looked from one to the other of the captors, eyeing them suspiciously.
We are not robbers, if that is what you are thinking. We are king's men.
Since when do king's men arrest innocent citizens and abuse them for no reason?
Innocent citizens have nothing to fear from us. Why did you run?
I was frightened. I found the village deserted and...
And then you heard us coming and hid.
Yes. Now let me go!
We will let you go in good time, but you have pricked our curiosity, and we wish answers to our questions first.
Quentin turned and began sloshing toward the shore. Suddenly, he felt his knees buckle. His back and shoulders were pummeled with fierce blows. He twisted underwater and was trying to haul himself back to his feet when the attack was broken off. Tolly was gripping the young lady by the arms, having pulled her off Quentin. The servant then pushed her, clawing and kicking, toward the shore. Tolly's face wore a strange, ridiculous grin.
How is this possible?
Thedo's eyes scanned the blackened plain where the village of Haladim had been.
There must be something left, though it does not look promising.
Ronsard motioned to his knights, so the party started down the gentle hill above the flat valley of Haladim. Each man's face wore a look of grim wonder, and each man's mind echoed Thedo's thought. How was it possible that an entire village could be annihilated so completely? There was nothing left of Haladim, but a blackened spot on the earth. Not a timber stood. Not a stone was left standing upon another. The entire area where the town had been was now a raised jumble of destruction.
Even the birds have finished with it.
Not quite. Look over there.
Thedo gazed a short distance away. Ronsard followed his look and saw a large flapping buzzard settle himself upon the remnant of a tree trunk. Three scolding ravens flew up from where they had been busily feeding on the ground.
Let us seek what draws their interest. Spread out and search the ashes for any sign of who this enemy might be.
Then Ronsard and Thedo reined their horses toward the place where the buzzard was now hopping along the length of burned trunk. The bird was eyeing something on the ground below. What it was could not be determined. They moved through the midst of the destroyed village. Scattered among the ashes were the charred remains of the everyday life of the simple villagers. An iron tripod with its battered pot nearby. A small stone statue of a household god, the blackened shards of a wine jug. And here and there lay the remains of hapless villagers, a sooty skull staring vacantly skyward, a long, clean length of shin bone, the curved hole of a rib cage rising from the desolation. The vulture took disgruntled flight at the approach of the horses and lifted itself slowly into the sky to circle high overhead with the ravens.
By the gods.
What?
Then Ronsard too saw what Thedo had seen.
By Orphe, no!
Thedo had already thrown himself from his mount and was tugging at the lashings of his saddle for his waterskin. Ronsard, entranced by the sight before him, dismounted slowly and stepped closer. He placed a hand on the hilt of his sword and was drawing the blade when Thedo touched his arm.
No need for that, I think. He is beyond pain, beyond suffering.
As Thedo spoke, the object of their attention, a badly burned torso of a body, jerked convulsively, and a yellow eye rolled toward them. Thedo knelt gently down beside the carcass and offered his water skin.
Peace, friend. Here is water for your parched tongue.
Thedo was on his knees, gently bringing the tip of the skin within reach of the cracked mouth. He allowed a few drops of water to seep out and dampen the man's lips. The black tongue poked out and moistened itself with the water. The cracked eyelids fluttered, and the dry eyeballs rolled in their sockets. Miraculously, the water seemed to take effect, and the eyes cleared with recognition.
How is this poor creature still alive?
I do not know, but perhaps he may tell us something of what happened here before Hoth claims him. Can you speak, friend? We are king's men, and your answers would do your king's service.
Ronsard turned away from the stench which assailed his nostrils. The man was burned horribly. Great areas of his chest and arms were charred black. The lower part of his body had been crushed by the tree when it fell. He lay in a shallow depression in the ground, half twisted on his side. His hair had been burned off one side of his head. On the other, a few dark strands still clung to the bare scalp, to trail in the breeze.
Let him die in peace.
No. No.
Both men looked down into the eyes and saw a glimmer which held them. The man was trying to speak.
Easy, easy. We hear you. Let me come close to listen.
Thedo leaned forward and placed his ear directly above the man's lips.
Tell us what happened, if you can.
I have been waiting for someone to come. Waiting. Waiting.
We are here now. Your vigil is over. Can you tell us anything?
All killed. All destroyed. Burned. Everything.
Yes, we see. Who did it? Do you know?
The Destroyer God. 10 feet tall. Fire spewed from his mouth. Everything destroyed.
Just the god alone?
No. Oh, many soldiers. They say...
What did they say? Tell me, and then it is over. The god will take you to your rest.
Beware. In the destroyer.
The yellowed eyes grew cloudy and still. There was not enough breath left to make a last gasp, but Ronsard fancied he felt the last remnant of life flee the broken form that had held it so long against its will. Thedo stood slowly.
Have you seen enough, my friend?
Here, yes. But I would like a look at this enemy that strikes helpless villages and kills the defenseless.
That we shall have ere long, I believe. But now is not the time for it. We should return at once with word of what we have seen. When next we ride, it will be with 1,000 at our backs.
Aye, you speak my feelings.
Thedo paused and seemed to regard something on the far horizon.
What is it, Thedo? Does something trouble you yet?
When Thedo turned back to Ronsard, a strange light shone in his eyes. He turned again to the horizon. A shadow moved across the valley,
I am afraid, Ronsard.
You? Afraid? How little you know yourself, sir.
Don't you feel it? No? I wonder.
Speak your mind, Thedo. Let there be nothing between us now. You have a foreboding, I can tell. Out with it! Do not fear you will unsettle me unduly. I am man enough to ride my thoughts with a tight rein, I assure you.
Very well, you are right, of course. But it is not so easily put into words. Just now, as we were talking, I had a feeling that we were riding down a narrow path whose end lay in darkness, and darkness was falling all around. That is all, just that. But it made me afraid.
Ronsard studied his friend carefully.
We were together, you and I? Well, come what may, that is enough for me. It will be a dark path indeed that daunts these two knights. But come, this is an evil place. Let us return at once to Ascalon for the King's Council. I fear we have been too long absent already.
We shall return as you say, fair friend. But I would that we had seen this mysterious enemy and knew somewhat of his strength in numbers. I would feel better if we could but see his face.
Oh, so should I. But perhaps that time is not far hence. We may yet encounter him before reaching Ascalon, though we are ill prepared for battle.
I have no wish to engage an unknown enemy, brave sir. Only to espy his methods. All the more since this one seems so fantastic to believe.
Ronsard swung himself up onto his mount.
Be mounted, men! We are away for Ascalon!
The knights took their saddles and began riding back up the hill the way they had come. But this time, they gave the charred circle on the plain a wide berth. Thedo stood for a moment beside his horse, gazing far away. He spurred his horse forward and did not look back.